last Monday and Tuesday, the last week, I was down in Edinburgh at a conference, and the conference was called Preaching Today. It was sponsored by Neil's Ministries Council, the Church of Scotland, and also New College, the training college for ministers in the University of Edinburgh. And I thought, after that, after 2 days of that, I thought, this is probably the worst sort of preparation for preaching on the following Sunday. Because I've been sitting there listening to a succession of very good speakers speaking about their area of expertise, which is the theory and practice of preaching. And there was a lot of things to take away and think about. But that's the whole point. You need time after an event like that to think about these things and decide what you're going to be able to use yourself and what you're going to set aside. Because as a preacher, you have to be yourself. You can't be somebody else. You can't pretend to be somebody else. So you have to find your own approach and style. So going to a conference like that will help you adjust, help you remember things that you're supposed to know and had forgotten, and so on. But, of course, in doing that, it makes you very aware of your own shortcomings. So it was with some relief that when I got back and looked on Wednesday morning at the gospel passage for today, I saw that it's one of my favourite passages. So I thought, well, I can't go too far wrong, hopefully, with that. You remember Rabbi Lionel Blue, the Jewish rabbi, used to do a lot of thought for the day things on the radio, on Radio 4 in the morning. And in one of his messages some years ago, he was talking on the subject of happy endings. And he finished with this: and the Gospels end surprisingly and delightfully with a fish barbecue at the seaside. Look it up for yourself in the last chapter of John. Typical Lionel Blue kind of statement. And it is a great way to end the Gospel story. Jesus with his closest friends on a beach enjoying a barbecue. Jesus is back. After 3 years with them, the disciples had gone through that traumatic week in Jerusalem. And while they were still in despair about that, Jesus had appeared to them, proving that he had defeated death. He appeared and then disappeared. And they were still trying to work out what they were supposed to do next. And Matthew tells us that an angel and then Jesus himself appeared to the two Marys to tell the disciples to go on to Galilee and that he would meet them there. So they'd done that, they'd gone back to Galilee, but they'd no idea what they were supposed to do. So the fishermen amongst them went back to what they knew, fishing. Carry on with their old lives, the lives they had before Jesus had turned up. But here he is, back again. Like once before, 3 years earlier, when he had called them. And on that occasion, he told them, as he did now, how to fish, the thing they were supposed to be the experts in. Now, numbers have a great significance in the Bible, or they can have. One is the vital number of exclusivity. We worship one God. We share one faith. We administer one baptism. We have the scriptures in one Bible, and so on. Then there's number three, the three persons of the Trinity, the three ways in which the one God reveals himself to his people. There's the number 12, the 12 tribes of Israel, and then the 12 apostles, the representatives of the new Israel, the church. 40, that's another number that keeps cropping up. It's to do with testing. Every time you hear the number 40, it's in relation to some sort of test. There were 40 days of the flood. There were 40 years during which Israel wandered in the desert. There were the 40 days and nights that Jesus fasted in the desert before being tempted by the tempter. But it's also the number of days between Easter and the Ascension. And that's the period that we're looking at now in our Bible readings. There are, of course, many other significant numbers. I'm sure somebody must have written a book on all these numbers, but if they haven't, maybe I'll get around to it one day. So what about the number in this passage that we looked at this morning? 153. the number of fish. Now, one of the problems is that sometimes, because numbers can be very significant in the Bible, some people then look for significance in every number that's mentioned. And so it is with this 153. Someone has suggested that this might have been the number of known varieties of fish at the time. So this would represent all the peoples of the world, or all the known peoples of the world. Well, I don't know how they got the idea that there were 153 varieties and that's how many people would have known. It's just guesswork. Another thing that was suggested was that this was maybe the number of believers at the time. And we know there weren't huge numbers of believers at that time. But Paul tells us in his first letter to the Corinthians that Jesus appeared after his resurrection. He appeared to over 500 people at one time. So that suggests that there were a lot more than 153 believers. Well, I prefer a much simpler explanation for the 153, and that it's simply that somebody took the trouble to count them. They did that because it was such an impressive catch. And John, in his old age, as he wrote his account, remembered very well how many fish there had been. And in that abundance of fish, there is a message, or rather two messages, a material message and a spiritual message. Well, first the material message, and it was one for those disciples, and it also has implications for us. Peter and Zebedee, and Zebedee's sons, James and John, who were disciples, had a business. And we know that at that time, fish from Galilee was salted and then was sent to other parts of the Roman Empire. And the business must have done quite well, because we know that John had a base in Jerusalem of some sort and was known to the high priest's household. So he was well connected. He probably delivered fish to these places and to the palace. The first time the disciples took in a miraculous fish, a catch of fish, as we know in Luke's gospel, these fish would not have gone to waste, even though Peter and James and John were being called away by Jesus. Zebedee was left with the hired hands, that's what Luke tells us. And that business must have survived because Peter and the rest of them were able to take up where they had left off 3 years later. So I think the message from both these miraculous catches at the beginning of the 3 years and at the end of the 3 years was simple. Jesus was showing those young men, that God would continue to provide for them and their families. They weren't going to be able now to go back to their old lives. Jesus had new work for them to do, which would take some of them very far away, and some of them would never return to Galilee. But materially, they and their families would be taken care of. But there was also a spiritual lesson for them as well. The new work that Jesus had for them was as fishers of people. Going out to present the gospel with the challenge and the sheer beauty of the gospel, such that people who responded would find their lives were changed as they were called into and participated in the kingdom of God. So Jesus had prepared the fire on the beach, and he already had fish cooking on it. And he told the disciples to bring some of the fish they'd just caught to add to what he already had. And what they brought from that miraculous catch was only partly the result of their own efforts. They dragged the over-full net ashore, but the provision of those fish had been down to Jesus. So here was a parable for them being acted out. They could work away all night relying on their own skills, but in the end, they could only be successful when God was in it. And Jesus was showing them that he did want their offering, but they had to know that he was the real provider. And it would be just like this when they moved out to take the word into the world. That's the way the mission of the church works. We are to work, but in cooperation with God. If we're not doing what he's asked us to do, then we're going to waste our energies and end up frustrated. But if we pray, and if we listen to his promptings, then we as a church will prosper. But before the disciples could get going on this task, Jesus needed to deal with their failure. They'd all failed when things had got tough in Jerusalem. They'd all run off, and they all needed to know that their actions had not disqualified them. Now, some of us will remember, perhaps with a bit of a shudder, those frequent occasions in our school days when teams were being picked. And for those of us who weren't much good at sport, it could be a painful, humiliating experience. The team leaders were usually picked because they were really good at whatever the sport was. And then they would start to select from the gathered class the ones they wanted in their team. And as the team grew, they conferred with each other and looked at the remnant to decide which of them would be least advantageous to their chances of winning. Well, maybe that's how these guys felt. Would Jesus, who had picked them all once before, would he want them back on his team after their pathetic showing last time out? Well, his response was to do something that he'd done before. He invited them to eat with him. He invited them to bring what they had and put it with what he already had. And then he took the bread and gave it to them, a clear reminder of their last meal together before his suffering. They were in. They were forgiven. They were restored. And they were commissioned for new work. But for Peter, Jesus needed to do something more. Peter had been appointed as a leader. Peter had boasted that even if all the others deserted Jesus, he never would. His failure had been the most dramatic. His fall had been the furthest. It's interesting to see how John in his gospel presents Peter's denial, because it's subtly different from the way the other gospels have it. Because John takes us into the courtyard beside a charcoal fire, and Peter is asked these questions. You are not also one of this man's disciples, are you? And Peter says, I am not. Peter did not so much deny Christ as to deny his own identity as a follower of Jesus. It wasn't forgiveness he needed so much as an opportunity to respond again to Christ's call on his life. And so Jesus asks him three times about his love, to cancel out his three times denial of his identity as a follower of Christ. And each time Jesus recommissions Peter to do his work. Feed my lambs. Take care of my sheep. Feed my sheep. And his final instruction in this conversation was simple. Follow me. Peter was being appointed by Jesus as a shepherd of the sheep, as Christ himself had been. But Christ would remain the good shepherd. The sheep would remain Christ's. But Peter was being called into that leadership role under Christ. And that's the calling of any in Christian leadership. So if you feel you may have lost your identity as a Christian somewhere along the line, then maybe this is the message you need to hear this morning. That Jesus is reminding you who you really are. And he's also saying to you that he has no one else to fill the vacancy. You are unique in your personality, in your network of relationships, in your position in the church, your position in your community. And he has called you to be his follower in this place, at this time, in this generation. And he wants you back in position. One of the things that happens if you're doing a lot of preaching is that you're always on the lookout, whether consciously or subconsciously, for illustrations. Incidents, stories, jokes, something which will help to illustrate a point in a sermon or a children's address or talk. Ministers are the greatest plagiarists. We're always trying to find ideas and take them from other people. Well, sometimes you get an illustration just when you need it as you're preparing a particular sermon. But other times you have an illustration in search of a sermon. Well, I remember one young man who was in the very early stages of his preaching career. He hadn't preached much at all, maybe even his second or third sermon. And he started off his sermon with an amusing story that he'd heard. But I strongly suspected as he went on that he'd chosen his text to suit this story that he wanted to tell us. The story, by the way, if you want to hear it, do you want to hear the story? I thought you would, yeah. It was an old Scottish minister somewhere in the West, we'll say vaguely, not to be too specific. And he was preaching on Psalm 42, which we know as the deer pants for the water, you know the one? But he, of course, was preaching from the Authorised Version, which begins, as the heart panteth after the water brooks, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. And supposedly this old minister finished his sermon with an impassioned plea to his congregation. God wants your pants. Bring your pants to him. Well, anyway, that was the story, and the sermon for this young man went on from there. But you'll be pleased to know that that particular young man who told that story has gone on to a wonderful ministry. And in the course of that, he has not lost his sense of humour. Anyway, it wasn't me, by the way, in case you're wondering. It was not me. Somebody else. Right, you would please... Yeah, sorry. Anyway, something odd happened to me this week while I was in Edinburgh. Some of the seminar groups at the conference were actually in New College, which is where the assembly meets. You know, the college is in there on the mound in Edinburgh. And I turned up for one of these seminars. It was called What is Missional Preaching? I'm actually not sure whether I learned the answer at the end of it, but that's not the point of the story. Now, normally when you turn up there, they've put a new entrance there, a glass-fronted entrance in the old building, which you'd know if you've gone to New College. And normally you need a card to get in. The students all have a card, or you need a code, and there's a key thing you're punching in the number to get in the door. So I turned up at this door and stood there, looking at the keypad and thinking, well, I don't have a number, I don't have a card, there must be some sort of buzzer to press to attract the attention of the people inside to get in. And then I looked up and I noticed there were two people inside and they were looking at me rather puzzled. And then they started smiling and they beckoned me in. And it still took me a moment to realise that the glass door was already open. Because so many people were coming and going, they propped the door open. So it was the opposite of walking into a glass door when you don't see it. I thought there was a glass door there, but there wasn't. Well, of course, it was quite funny, and there was a bit of banter as I eventually went in. But it wasn't long before my brain was thinking, that might make a good illustration for something. So here's the point. If you're feeling that you're going to have to do something special to get back in God's favour, you need to do something good that you can show him, or you need to learn some theological truth that you've maybe missed, and that will be the key to opening the door. Well, the message to you is the door is already open, and Jesus is beckoning you to cross the threshold. So listen to his call to you. When Jesus approached again, those disciples who had failed, they were probably expecting judgment. But it's striking that in this passage that we read, that we don't see anything resembling a court of law. There's no prosecuting lawyer. There's no procession of witnesses to recount their misdeeds. There isn't an unsympathetic jury ready to give a guilty verdict. And there isn't a stern judge looking down on them from the bench, waiting to pronounce sentence. Instead, we see the way of Jesus, a meal around another charcoal fire, a stroll along the beach, an arm around the shoulder. Earlier in his ministry, it had been a chat with a Samaritan woman while she drew water at a well, saying to a woman caught in adultery, "Neither do I condemn you. Now go and sin no more." inviting himself for dinner at the home of the notorious tax collector, Zacchaeus. That's the way of Jesus. Do not fear his condemnation, but instead experience his loving arm around your shoulder and his quiet words of forgiveness and reassurance that he wants you on his team.